The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. It's my pleasure to welcome our guest this evening. From his remarkable memoir, A Long Way Gone, all of us now know of Ishmael Bia's harrowing life as a boy soldier in the war in Sierra Leone, before he was removed from the army by UNICEF, rehabilitated in Freetown, and eventually and remarkably made his way to New York City. So there, that's a whole lifetime in a sentence. In the intervening years, Bia attended the United Nations International School and later enrolled at Oberlin College, graduating in 2004 with a degree in political science. 3 years later, his best-selling memoir received international acclaim and prompted invitations to Mr. Bia to speak about the effects of war on children before the United Nations, which named him an ambassador and advocate for children, the Council on Foreign Relations, and many other institutions. In 2007, Mr. Bia launched the Ishmael Bia Foundation to support education initiatives and reintegrate child soldiers from Sierra Leone back into society. He comes to us tonight with his first novel, the optimistically entitled The Radiance of Tomorrow. One of my favorite writers, Edwige Dantaka, has this to say about the book. As Bia reminds us, every story is a birth. In Radiance of Tomorrow, Bia has produced a formidable and memorable novel, a story of resilience and survival, and ultimately, rebirth. Please welcome Ishmael Bia.
Thank you. Thank you to the library for having me and to all of you for being here this evening, for walking through the cold and coming here. I appreciate that very much. What I'm going to do is to speak a little bit about this novel and maybe read a few excerpts here and there, and then I'll open it up to your questions. The writing of this novel really came about while I was touring for the previous book, the memoir, A Long Way Gone. And through that, I began to observe a few things that people were really interested in countries, particularly the media, when it was at war, when the bloodshed was unfolding. And as soon as one country's bloodshed ended, and there was a peace process or whatever, the gun silenced, the media turned to the next bloodshed and the next hot spot, and nobody paid attention to what happens when the gun silenced. How do people go back home? Why do they go back home? Is it possible to go back to the way their lives had been? If not, what forms of their traditions do they repair, and what does that say about them as a community? Also, during a war, people go into different parts of the country, so they're exposed to different realities. Some even become refugees in other countries. So when they return, they come with ideas of how their lives need to be in the future. Is that possible in the wake of the war? In addition to this, when people return also, they are coming from different sides of the war. Some have been perpetrators, some have been victimized to become perpetrators, and they all have to learn to live together again. Is that possible? How do you do that? How do you move towards a future when this past is still trying to pull at you? How do you learn to trust the innocence of a young child who had been given a weapon to destroy and bring violence in the community again? So all of these questions are asked through a set of characters that arrive in a town called Imperi. They start to come, beginning with an elder who arrives first, because that is rightly so in the tradition, the elders are the ones who are supposed to rekindle their broken friendship with the land. So they come and they begin to clean up, because when wars end, you even have to clean up the very bones themselves. During war, when people are being gunned down, nobody's going around burying anyone at all. So when you return, you have to clean that. Also, you have to clean even the grasses that have grown in the houses and the trees, because the human presence is no longer there. You have to cut them off so they can actually retreat. So you see the elders come, and then other people begin to come. You see an amputated man who comes back with two of his children who had been amputated in the war. His name is Sila. And then a former child soldiers return. One of them had actually amputated his family. And they start to live in this community again. A young woman returns who had had a child during the war. And that child is a reminder of the suffering she had gone through during the war. And she returns and tries to live in this community as well. Two teachers return and try to revive an educational system in the community again. And then other challenges begin to come about this community. Now, there are several other things that I'm trying to get at as well in this narrative, which is that even when you return, you have to begin to trust in this place itself again in the way you had done things. Before the war, when you greeted somebody in the morning, there were elaborate greetings. You would say to somebody, how are you? How is your mother? How is your grandmother? How is your grandson? Elaborate greeting. They would tell you in detail about how everyone was, and they would ask you a question in return. Now, after the war, you could not do this, because to say that, you did not know what somebody had lost. So to ask them these questions would open up the wounds they may have been trying to heal for years. So all of this hesitation is in the air when people return. Also, sudden images have changed. Before the war, a boy with a machete on a path, nobody felt anything. Nobody hesitated or flinched. But after the war, that image was no longer just a boy going to harvest a crop or to brush a farm. It was a boy who could use it to do something with it. That was bad. So when you encounter somebody on the path with a machete, you hesitated. Sometimes even when an SUV truck would drive by, women who were walking on the road would start running a little bit because it reminded them of during the war when soldiers would drive like this and start shooting at people. So how do you learn to function in this environment again? Is it really possible? How do you preserve what means the most to you in this uncertain time of your life? And what does that say about you? Also, when people come back, the sense of power had shifted during the war, where young people had been given a rare sense of it, of power, because of the weapons they carried, and they no longer respected the elders. Now, when they return, the elders are trying to bring back the oral tradition storytelling into their lives, to infuse them with the wisdom that they've been missing for all this time. How do they get them to sit down and listen? Because some of them are quite restless. How do they begin to transmit that knowledge again to strengthen their spirit? Because in this context, and also in Sierra Leone's context, we think of story and stories as medicine that you insert in the minds of the young, in the hearts of the young of people, that it can then become relevant to them at some point in their lives, whenever they can notice when they need to use that story. So you have to find the time and the right place to put that knowledge in them and to tie them to their traditions. So all of these things you see unfolding in this narrative. Now, another thing is that people come back also, the older people want to go back to what they know before. And the younger people want a newer thing, but they don't really know exactly what that is. So then you have that difficulty as well. But in order for me to achieve all of these things, there are several things I needed to do with this narrative, which is that I realized very quickly that I needed to write it not in a conventional way that you, some of the novels that you've read before, which is that I needed to think in the languages that the elders were speaking. In Sierra Leone, we have a lot of languages, and mine is the Mende. Language and the tribe that I grew up in. And the way people will speak are very figurative, and the language is very image-driven and beautiful in its own way. So I would think about it in Mende, and I would try to find the English equivalent of what I was trying. And it's a big challenge. Sometimes there's no equivalent. Because the reason why I'm doing this, I believe that language has to fit landscape. If I were to write, otherwise the story doesn't, you can't take, transport the person to the place you want to keep them. If I were to say, in the African context or in the context of Sierra Leone, that an adult was referring to you guys, to children, it would not work because elders do not say you guys. That would mean that they are somewhere else. They would say children, boys and girls. They would not say you guys. It's a very Western usage of the word. So when I'm writing, I'm very careful about how language fits the landscape, because it also comes from the oral tradition. It's the way that you can actually capture somebody's imagination and bring them to that landscape. So a lot of translations are occurring, and sometimes they are equivalents that are very beautiful, and sometimes I just find a way to bring about an image that would give you that idea. Now, I don't go about and become more flowery, because also the oral tradition doesn't accept that, because you have to get to the point of what you want to say. You can't just beat around the bush all day long. I learned this the very hard way, even before I knew I could be a writer. When I was a boy growing up in my village in Sierra Leone, the southern part, I was one of the literate boys in my town, and I had the fortune of writing letters for a lot of people. So through this, I learned the secrets of people in the community. And some of them gave me money and food for lunch, and I had the suspicion that they did so for me to keep their secrets, not necessarily for the task that I was completing for them. But anyway, I learned a lot of things, but I also learned certain ways that sometimes people say things and they actually just want to make a point. I remember on one occasion, a mother who really had missed her son very much wanted him to return. He was in the capital city, and she came to me to write the letter. And she started by saying, "Please tell my son, the one that I was pregnant with for 9 months, the one that I went in labor with for X number of hours, the one that when he was born, he cried for nearly 2 months, I could not sleep, the one when he first shat in his pants, I had to take him to the river to wash him, that, you know, he should come home, his mother misses him." So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, so I just wrote, "You must come home now. Your mother really misses you." You know, okay, all of this. You have to get to the point at some point. Anyway, so I learned at a very early age some of these translations. but I also, so when I'm writing, I'm trying to find the English equivalent in some of the things that I'm doing. I will give you a few examples. In Mende, and so other languages in Sierra Leone as well, they have their own ways of rendering certain sentences. How you say night came suddenly, you say the sky rolled over and changed its size. That's the translation. So if I were to say the sky rolled over and changed its size, you know you are in a different landscape immediately. The narrative is going to hold you somewhere else. Now, how you say, when we describe objects, we also describe the components of those objects, not just the object itself. In English, when you say a ball is just a ball. In Mende, it's called fefete, which means a nest of air or a vessel that carries air. So if I were to say the children kicked around a nest of air or a vessel that carries air, all of a sudden it's a newer usage of the English language itself. So I'm recreating it to fit the traditions and the wisdom from where these characters inhabit. And also, you know, when you say somebody's thoughts are scattered, you say your mind was like an anthill filled with smoke. If you think about it, you take a firewood and you put it in an ante, all the ants will start going out the other way. So literally, that's the meaning. So people speak like this back home. So when I'm writing, I try to find ways to bring all of this together. Now, when the younger people speak, sometimes they don't speak like this. There are some ways it's just how they will say things in a very ordinary way. But when you go towards closer to the capital city, as this narrative unfolds, you see that the language is not like this, because when you live in the capital city, whatever language you speak becomes more, it's filled with more English words because you're in the capital city. So in Mende, for example, how you will say a bicycle in the capital city, if you're a Mende living, it will be different from how you will say it if you're in the countryside. Now, in the capital city, you just say bicycle. But in the countryside, there's no word for it because it's a foreign introduction into the culture. So what we have for it is the sound itself that the bicycle makes. And so now I try to find a way, how do I get that in the narrative, you know? And the sound that the bicycle makes, we have this old sort of Chinese model bicycle, which is one speed. It's a Phoenix bicycle. When you ring the bell, it goes, "Giriginje, giriginje," you know? So the name of the bicycle is called Giriginje. So it's the sound that it makes, not necessarily because we don't have something for it. Now, another technique that I also try to use is this idea of sound. When you're telling a story in Mende, the oral tradition, which I borrow from a lot, the way I write, because I grew up sitting around the fire every evening, and the older people would tell stories, and this is how we learned about our moral and ethical standards. This is how we learn about our traditions and culture. And even as a kid, we'll be told this story will make sense to you at some point in your life, and you say, all right, sure. And later on, it would make sense to you. For example, at the end of my memoir, I tell a story about a hunter who goes into the forest to, 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 to kill an animal. He had a rifle, and he saw, he was looking for one, and then he saw a monkey, and he lifted his rifle and aimed, and then the monkey spoke and said, "Oh, hold on a second, man, you know, said, if you shoot me, your mother will die, and if you don't, your father will die. When I was a boy, they would tell the story in front of your mother and your father, and you were asked to come up with an answer. I always said I wanted to go to the bathroom so I didn't have to answer the question. But of course, when I returned, I was still asking. I would say, oh, I won't go hunting any animals that's going to speak to a human being. I'll find ones that are not going to speak. We'll come up with all sorts of things. But they always say, no, you have to find the answer. And I'll ask my grandmother afterwards, why are you telling us this story? And she would say, it will become useful to you later in your life. Just keep it in your mind. Keep it in your bloodstream. And later after the war, the story actually made sense to me. I understood that what they were trying to explain to us was the fact that once violence commences, there's a consequence, and it's not going to be one that you like necessarily. When you lift the hand to strike somebody, you're going to have a consequence. When you lift the gun to shoot somebody, there's a consequence. It took me till after the war to understand that. But that medicine was already put inside me to prepare me for that time, you know. So this is what stories really are. But to come back to some of the techniques that I used, when they are telling a story, sometimes there are sounds that illustrate something or gives an explanation of something. If you're saying that somebody was running, you will say, he ran, took, 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 took. She ran, kuju, 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 kuju. These are two different meanings of how the person is running. Now, took, took, took means the person was running during the daytime. Because during the daytime, when you're running, your footsteps are lighter because there are other sounds that are occurring. There's a blacksmith hitting something, birds are singing, maybe a vehicle is going by, children are shouting at the river, and things like that. So it's very light. Now, at night, when other sounds have quieted, when you run, your footsteps are much heavier. And I'm sure you've all have experienced it. And the closest thing maybe I can explain to you is that if you live below somebody, when they walk up and down at night, you can hear them more at night than you would during the day because other sounds are quieter. So when they're telling a story, and they said, and the character ran, kuju, 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 everybody knew it was nighttime. They didn't need to explain to you that it was nighttime. So when I'm writing, I try to bring all of this knowledge also and infuse it into this novel so you can see the things that I'm trying to do. The last thing that I will say, and I will read one or two excerpts from the novel itself, is that for me, also, even in my memoir and also in this novel, nature is not just an observer. It's also a character in the way I write. Because the way people function on the land affects nature itself and vice versa. For example, during the war, when the gunshots came about, the birds stopped singing and they ran away. It was as if you can feel that nature itself was afraid of what was unfolding. So in this narrative, you begin to see nature as another character as well. The way the trees sway to the wind, or the way the clouds move, these are all sort of, I personify them to show what is to come so that you can feel it. Because I grew up also in the countryside. So this sections that I will read, you will hear some of these things. This is the beginning. I'm going to start from the beginning, and I'm just going to jump around a little bit to share a few things. And then I'll read another section, and then I'll take some questions. It is the end, or maybe the beginning, of another story. Every story begins and ends with a woman, a mother, a grandmother, a girl, a child. Every story is a birth. She was the first to arrive where it seemed the wind no longer exhaled. Several miles from town, the trees had entangled one another. Their branches grew toward the ground, burying the leaves in the soil to blind their eyes so the sun would not promise them tomorrow with its rays. It was only the path that was reluctant to cloak its surface completely with grasses, as though it anticipated it would soon end its starvation for the warmth of bare feet that gave it life. Evening was approaching, and the sky was preparing to roll over and change its sides. She sat on the ground, allowing the night's breeze to soothe her face and her pain, to dry her tears, When she was a child, her grandmother told her that at the quietest hours of night, God and gods will wave their hands through the breeze to wipe just a few things off the face of the earth so that you'll be able to accommodate the following day. Though her pain didn't completely disappear with the arrival of morning, she felt some new strength within her heart that gave her the idea to pluck herself from the earth and begin cleaning the bones. She rounded the corner and dropped the pile, her heart sinking to her waistbone at the resounding thud of the bones hitting the dusty earth. Her feet gave way under her body as she saw the back of a man sitting on his knees, tying bones together as one would a bundle of kindling. She could tell that this was an old man, as his hair was the color of stagnant clouds. The man's movement expressed his age. This brought her heart back to its proper place, allowing the rest of her body to resume its many functions. The old man, sensing a shadow behind him, spoke, "If you are a spirit, please pass by peacefully. I am doing this work to make sure that when people return to this town, they may not see this. I know their eyes have recorded worse, but still, I will spare them one last image of despair. I will help you then." She lowered herself and began picking up the bones she had dropped and some more, making her way toward him. "I know that voice. Is that you, Kadi?" He trembled, his hands unable to do what they had been doing since he had arrived as the sky was wiping the last residues of sleep from its surface. Kadi answered quietly, as though afraid to disturb the deep silence that had come about just that moment. His heart hesitated to give permission to his face to turn around and greet his friend. He sat for some time watching his shadow move, and all the while he could hear Kadi rattling the bones and sighing as she continued her work. Turning to see her would give his heart the burden of coming to terms with whatever condition she was in. She might be amputated, deformed in some way or another. He sat some more in his torment, and Kadi decided to end his hesitation. "Please remove your eyes from the body of the earth and see your friend. I am sure your heart will perform a joyful dance when you see that I am as well as I can be." She placed her right hand on his shoulder. He held onto her hand and slowly, like a child caught making mischief, he lifted his head. His eyes surveyed the body of his friend while his mind confirmed. "Her hands are both there. Her legs too. Nose, ears, lips. I am here, Moiwa. All of how I came into this world is here." Her voice stopped his mind's roll call on her body parts. Now, what I was trying to say there is also even the burden of when you saw people that you hadn't seen for a while and you hurt them, you were afraid to turn around and see them because whatever condition they were in, you would have to carry some of that burden a little bit. So sometimes that hesitation itself was in the air. But then, of course, as time goes on, all of these things would change. I'm going to read another short chapter and then I will end, another short area, because one of the young men who returns is a fellow called Honest, and during the war he had a different name, and he's the one who had amputated his family, and he tries to return to see if he can make amends with them, but it is not easy, and it takes time for him to even begin getting closer to them. And sometimes he would do them favors. For example, he would go fetch water for them and he would leave it on the veranda and runs away and he would hide in the forest. And then they would come and they would be very happy. But if they saw that he was the one who gave them the water, they would not appreciate it. So he would do these gestures and slowly he begins to even be able to look at them and for them to look at each other. And eventually things change between them, but it's not that simple. But this is the incident that occurred. In the morning, the commander asked a slim little boy with a long, rough, pimpled face, they called him Sergeant Cutlass, to chop off the family's hands. "I am in a very good mood, so you only have your hands cut off. You can keep your lives for today," the commander had said. "I am giving you my best man for the job. He is so good that by the time you think about it, it will be finished." He laughed and called on the sergeant. The young boy's sunken face was as cold as the blades he carried. All of them had residues of blood and flesh, and some were dull while others were very sharp. Depending on how much pain the commander wanted his victims to feel, he would ask for either a dull or sharp machete. This young boy had been forced at gunpoint to do his first cutting when he was 9 years old, and they were the hands of his mother, father, grandmother, and two uncles. After the commander had killed them because the boy didn't do the job to his liking, "It wasn't as clean as I wanted," he had said before shooting all of them. The commander had then made the boy part of the group to fight as a soldier and with the special task of chopping off hands only. "Okay, bring them here," the commander asked for Sila and his children to be brought to the log near the bushes. "Sergeant Cutlass, go on and we move out after. One last thing. If any of you make any noise, I will have you all shot." He laughed as the hands of the children were first placed on the logs and cut, and then it was Sila's turn. Sergeant Cutlass had cut many hands, but this was the second time that it tormented him. The first had been his family. He didn't know what it was, but something about this family got to him. He had also never witnessed such silence from cuts. Even when the commander threatened to shoot people, they cried out. Not this family, though. The silence made him hear the sound that the machete made when it went through the flesh, the bone, and then the flesh again, finally hitting the log. Now, people come back with all of these burdens and everything, and they begin to live in this place, and of course their life begin to flourish a little bit. And they are faced with other challenges that you will discover as you read this novel. But the point that these characters would really have you understand, and this speaks a lot to the vibrancy of people in a place like Sierra Leone or other war-torn places, is this idea that they have this understanding that happiness is not a continuous thing, a moment. And happiness is not the absence of challenge, of a challenge or challenges in one's life. It's with these challenges, the ability to seize those moments and actually live fully. And that's really where the strength of these characters come from. So even though there's a backdrop of all of these things going on, they're able to love each other truly, create families. If they go to a disco, they will dance like there's no tomorrow. If they watch a football, soccer match, they will shout and debate about it vigorously. And all of these things will occur with the challenges that life throws everyone as well. So with that said, I do hope you would get to meet these characters in this narrative. One of the most important things about oral tradition storytelling in that tradition is the fact that stories are only good if they are passed on. Otherwise, they will die. And when the stories die, it dies with the traditions, it dies with the knowledge of the ancestors, the wisdom of the elders, and all of it. So I hope you can pass on the story to others, because we need to keep putting it in newer vessels so that it can actually live, because the stories outlive us. And that's how we leave traces of who we had been into the generations that will come after and after. So thank you for your attention so far. And we are going to... there are microphones, so raise your hand, I will call upon you, and they will give you the microphone, and you will ask a question, and I will do my best to answer.
Hi, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. My question is, you were talking a lot about stories being medicine, and I was wondering what kind of medicine you would like your book to be. What do you want people to take away from it when they read it?
You know, as a writer, you will have ideas about what people could get from your stories, but then the reader can make certain conclusions themselves, and this is all part of it, you know. But what I really want people to get from it is this question about what do you really preserve at the most uncertain time in your life? What do you preserve for yourself, and what does that say about you? And also this idea of happiness, that it's not the absence of challenge, of any challenge in one's life. That's not what happiness is. If you're looking for that, I'm not sure you're going to find it. Because every morning we're going to have challenges in our life. Some may be very small, some may be bigger, but there will be these moments of happiness that we should not overlook at all. So I hope you'll find that. And also you'll find things that I probably did not deliberately do, but that's the beauty of writing as well. And I would claim it and say, yes, I intended all of it. I'm just kidding, no. Yeah, there's somebody else had a question somewhere. Is there a hand? Yes.
Firstly, I want to thank you for this book because it has stayed with me since I finished reading it. And your portrayal of the land and of the people is so colorful that I felt transported there. I have kind of two questions. One, were the characters based on specific people you knew, or are they a composite of stories or people you knew? And number two, what's your next book?
This is good. Now, the story was, there's a composite of things that I've observed going back to my country after the war and other countries as well, because as a UNICEF ambassador and advocate for children affected by war, I go to a lot of war-torn countries, post-recovery, middle recovery, whatever you want to call them. I go, so I observe. So wherever I was, something about that place seeped into my imagination that then found its way into this narrative. Well, sometimes some of the characters, I try to imagine some people. For example, the elder that comes first, Mama Kadi, I try to imagine what it would have felt like for my grandmother to return home after the war. So I try to think in that sense. And I also try to step in the shoes of other people who I don't really know their experience during the war, not mine. So that's what I did, observation. Because in Sierra Leone, you cannot really interview people any longer for anything because they're exhausted. So many people have come to interview them about this and that, and so they don't want interviews. But because I speak the languages, I can engage in conversations with people casually, and I would ask them specific questions, and they will reveal certain things to me that then can become material for me. You know, so it comes with that beauty. But yeah, so pretty much that. And the second question is that I'm thinking of writing another novel. It is always the most sort of terrible thing for a writer to try and describe what they're working on. It doesn't work at all. So you just say you're working on a novel, and then you hope that when you're done, it would actually be something. So I'm working on a novel, but also I'm working on three things together, actually. A novel, a short story collection, and also the sequel of the first book. So I am not really sure which one would materialize itself first, but I probably think it will be a novel, because I think I want to hold off the writing nonfiction for a bit. It's very exhausting to write nonfiction emotionally. I don't think it's healthy to do two in a row, in my opinion. I could be wrong. Yeah, anyway. So stay tuned. In the meantime, read this one, and then we would... Yes. Any other question? Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ismail, what do you think of lack of cooperation between the people who are trying to make difference in Africa, like those countries who are trying to help Africa, and how somehow they sidestep the African Union, and somehow, instead of investing and funding the African Union, every country that's trying to help they like to do things in their own name. The British do things in their own name. The Chinese do things in their own names.
The question, really, I think the heart of it that you're asking is, why do we allow others to prescribe our dreams and our future for us? And we've seen that sort of solution doesn't work over the years. It's never worked. If the IMF structural adjustment programs go somewhere without consulting any local economist on the ground, they put something together, it fails immediately. So I think really the idea is that if people are really invested in helping people, they should ask them what it is that they want, not what they think the people want. Because again, coming back to this question of happiness, what we may consider happiness for us here is not what other people would want in their culture. My grandfather's happiest moment in his life was sitting every evening on the veranda and watching his grandchildren and his children just boisterously playing around. To him, this was the best a human being could achieve. Now, somebody could come and say, that's not enough. You need more. And then it becomes another issue. You know what I mean? And sometimes people are well-meaning when they go to help, but they don't stop to ask people really what they want, because they know where they live and they know what they need. If you ask them and you have a conversation with them, they could prescribe something for you that actually works. I'll give you one last example. A few years back, I was in northern Cameroon doing some work there, and very well-meaning people wanted to build water pumps, you know, because water was very hard to come by because it's very close to Chad, so it's a bit deserty. And this was a great thing. People needed water. But what they wanted was to build a water pump at every household. And to them, this was good because it comes from their own mentality. If everybody has water at home, this is good for you. But actually, the women did not want this. They wanted water wells all around town. Because when they leave home to go fetch water, this is when they congregate as women and they're able to have their own space and time. So when you put a pump in their homes, you take away that freedom from them, actually. But from the outset, it looks like it's a great project, right? But because nobody consulted the people on the ground, you're actually changing and giving them more burden than you would. So in a way, this is the heart of it. Unfortunately, people don't do it. We can have our own analysis about it. Maybe at the bottom of it, they don't really care to make any help, or maybe they really think what they're doing is going to work. I am not sure. But whatever it is, it hasn't worked since the beginning, and it will never work. So there's a need to try the other one. Eh? Maybe something good will come out of it. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what has worked with the children? I mean, your own experience, of course, as well, but what works to help children who have been through this kind of experience?
What works depends in the country. There's no sort of brand that you can take and put it everywhere, although there are certain things you can borrow here and there. Because even when children are recovering from trauma, what worked for me could not work for another child because everybody's traumatized differently. And also, for example, for kids who before the war had no stable family life, and some of them were even born during the war, they have no memory of a community life, of being loved, of having elders spoken to them. So you have to build that for them before you can even begin to heal them. For those who had it, it becomes a stepping stone, somewhere to go and spring from. You know, so there are all these things. But here are the things that work for me that I think is generally applicable everywhere. You have to provide a family stability for young people coming from war, genuine people who really care for them. Because the one thing that children know when they come from war, or from any kind of struggle or violence, they know, they can feel it when somebody is genuine or not with them. You can feel it 5 miles down the road when somebody's coming to talk to you. And if it's not, it's not going to work at all. So they can feel that. So to have a genuine family that begins to show them that people can actually love one another, or show that they love one another without any agenda. Because when you come out of a war, that's how you think. People only pretend to love each other because they want to do something to you. Now, after that, it's also opportunities. This is equally as important. When you create opportunities for young people, it allows them to begin to rediscover their own intelligence again and their own mind and their own spirit, and to find themselves useful, that they're not only capable of violence, but they can do other things. These are the things that worked for me. And with those opportunities, you begin to build newer memories that then compete with the war memories because you cannot get rid of them. So when you think of the war memories, eventually you will outrun them, right? You outnumber them. So those are the things anywhere that works. But of course, you cannot provide opportunity for somebody who lives in a war zone. Oftentimes, some of the things that are prescribed, when I was coming out of the war, I was at a rehabilitation center, they will come and ask everybody to become a mechanic, a plumber, a carpenter. Now, these are all great, professions if somebody wants to do them. But if nobody doesn't want to do them, then you're sort of belittling their intelligence, right? And also, if you live in a country where you have 50 cars and then you make 1,000 kids mechanics, immediately, statistically speaking, some of them are already out of jobs before they even finish the training, you know? So sometimes there's not really a market research done to see what did we train this young person with, so that, you know? So sometimes this is really what happens. It's teaching you to be a plumber. Most people don't even have running water. You're like, what am I going to do? I mean, you haven't seen a pipe in your life and you've been, you know? Anyway, so some of these things, there needs to be a market research that's done to see how you can connect people to the right, you know, opportunity. A few years ago, I was back home, and one of my friends from the war, I sat with him, and I said, what is it that you really like to do? And he said, well, I'm a businessman. I said, okay, can you explain what that means? He said, I have this idea that I want to start like a little internet place where people can come and check their internet, and then I'll put a little soda machine, and then it might make profit, I'll buy more. And I'll say, well, how much do you need to start this? She said, $600 to $1,000. I said, okay, I'll give you the money. You give me back my money with some interest. I was joking. I just wanted to be. So I gave him my own money, and he started his business. A few years later, this thing had grown bigger. But if he had expressed this after the war to somebody, they would have thought, no, he just wants the money to run with it. They wouldn't have trusted his intelligence because he's coming from a war. So people belittle your intelligence because of that, and that doesn't allow you to rise up, you know. And I think that's what needs to change in a lot of places. Yes.
I was going to ask, the stuff in the book, did that like really happen, or was like some of it like exaggeration?
Which book are you talking about now? The A Long Way Gone?
Yeah.
All of it happened. There's so many, many ones that I actually left out for the sanity of the readers, in a way. When I was writing this book, actually, when I first wrote it, the initial draft was about 500 pages, 1.5 spacing, I remember. It was quite big. So there was a lot of stuff in there. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, when I decided to publish it, you know, I want my readers to have a sense of the violence, but not to the point that it cripples them. Because I wanted people to understand, not to have any kind of bravado about violence, but to explain the violence for people to understand why they must resist it at all costs, you know. So, but it happens, and it's still happening, actually, as we speak, in many places around the world. For example, if you go home tonight, you should type in Central African Republic in Google, and you will see some of the things that I spoke about there, and even worse, are occurring there right now as we speak. So this goes on even as we speak. Yes.
I read somewhere where some third world countries have never developed telephone lines and et cetera. So those countries just skip that, and now they all have cell phones.
Yes.
Is this valid?
Yes, this is very valid, yes. Cell phone usage is pervasive everywhere now. If you go anywhere, actually people in various African countries, I'll take Sierra Leone for example, get more usage out of their mobile phones than we do. Because we have a computer and we have other ways of... That mobile phone is what they use to check the internet, to send in money for the trades that they do for whatever they're selling. In Kenya, for example, they have the M-Pesa, which is you don't have to even carry money. You can pay using your phone from send money to somebody's bank. So people do more with their phones, actually. And now, because the way the phone system is there is that you don't pay to receive a call. You only pay when you make a call. So a lot of people would have phone with a very minimum credit on it. So they will call you in Sierra Leone, what they call flash. So they will call you and they will hang up before you pick up. So then you call them back and then you will talk. Because you will pay and then they will pay. So everybody can afford to have a little phone with a small credit on it and you can call. I can call some of my uncles in the deep village who will be at the farm and be like, oh yeah, what's going on, you know. It's absolutely. And also in another phenomenon is that because of this, you know, in the United States, if you have a phone, you go to any other country, it's locked. So you can't use it. You need to buy another phone. In Sierra Leone, there are kids who learn how to unlock any phone that you can think of on the street. I don't know how they knew how to do it, but they figure it out. So these are brilliant minds, you know. If this guy was like somewhere in the United States, you'd be called, this guy is a technology whiz and a business savvy man, right? Because I've experienced, you see them in this narrative actually, they will come to you on the street and they will say, hey, oh, so I can unlock your phone so you don't have to buy a new phone if you pay a certain fee. And then they will do one free for you so you see that it works. And then all your friends that you're with will give that and they will unlock it. And they will make money. Now, when I saw this kid on the street, I thought, wow, this kid has business and technology skills. But nobody's giving him an opportunity, right? So he uses that to only survive. So anyway, like phones are everywhere. Yeah, definitely. Even people are on Twitter, Facebook. So sometimes when you say something about us now on the African continent that is not correct, people would respond. Because they are also listening to everything, you know. Yes.
Hi. As I just observe you, it's like such a pleasure. You feel to me like so joyful and peaceful and present. And in my experience with people and human nature, is that people that are in that place are healed and have a sense of maybe forgiveness towards whatever has occurred to them. I'm wondering, if it's not too much to ask, I mean, have you reached a place of forgiveness? And if so, I'm curious to know how you got there, because you don't seem to be someone that is holding a grudge.
Well, you know, I didn't just become, whatever this is you're sensing from, it didn't happen overnight. It took many, many years. There were times in my life, if you had met me, you would not want to ever see me again, you know. I was very violent, I was angry, I blamed everybody, and I knew how to settle anything that would occur to me violently. And I didn't allow anybody to come close to me in any way at all. But these things changed for several reasons, because I began to realize I was not even at peace with myself. I was so angry that the burden of everything that happened I knew would kill me if I didn't go the other way. So I had no choice, really. Rather, is to try to go the other way to see what was possible there to be able to live. And then through that, even though I had experienced human beings who were truly evil, I began to experience human beings who were truly good as well. And that began to change for me slowly. I didn't still just, you know, blindly trust people. I was still cautious a little bit, but that's what opened my heart a little bit and allowed me to allow even happiness and to believe even in the possibility of happiness. I used to think happiness is not possible, it's just another illusion, you know. And so I didn't want to be happy because I knew it would end and then I'd have to go back. So I just stayed in a certain state. But it took a lot of work and a lot of people who came into my life and that helped me along the way. I still have those human tendencies that everybody has, but I think I've seen so much that for me certain things do not worry me as much, you know. For example, if I'm on the train in New York where I live and somebody else is trying to read their paper while the train is filled, I just laugh because I think it's so funny, you know. Because what if everybody else decides to read their paper because they too paid the same amount, right? And we have chaos. But anyway, I just laugh and just go on the side and let them have whatever they need, you know. So certain things don't bother me because I know where I'm coming from. You know, I have this perspective. So, you know, if I'm... if a plane is delayed and everybody's upset, I just thought, what are you going to do? You know, just wait and see what happens. It's not the worst thing that could happen in your life, other things are happening that way. So I have this perspective and this humor, which is also medicine. Humor is medicine about some things, you know. So anyway, that's all I could say.
Hi, Ishmael. My name is Maurice Gray. I'm from West Africa. To be specific, I'm from Liberia.
Next door.
Yeah, next door. I heard somebody was asking the question whether if in your book or your stories, it was a lot of exaggerations. Mm. But I want to tell you again, it is not anything like exaggerations. This is real. Because if Ishmael continue to write his books and something like that, you know, I can tell this audience that the war started from Liberia and went over to Sierra Leone. And when I overheard him saying something about the long sleeve and the short sleeve thing, it did happen. And we fought like a 14 years of civil war and everything was torn apart. And so, but Ishmael, my question to you is that now that I know that you are from Sierra Leone and you are a very good writer, what are you doing or what do you include in your writing, you know, to help or like other countries like in the West, you know, that suffered a lot of devastations, you know, and so... I don't know what you guys are doing that, you know, in your writings, you know. So, but I would suggest and I would recommend that, you know, whenever you are writing about this war, you know, it's good that you go to nearby countries too and see how best you can be able to interview other people and add that within your writing. Do not even forget about Ivory Coast too.
Yes,
Ivory Coast, you know, a lot of devastations over there. A lot of destructions went on over there. And everybody, like, majority of the population, they are all traumatized, you know, and we, people are just, like, angry and then really angry, you know. So I'm urging you so that you can be able to help all the people so that the message can go through your writing. But I'm very happy. And then I'm from Coastville. I don't know whether you guys know.
Coastville,
yes. Yeah, Coastville. I'm from Coastville. It's about an hour Coastville. Drive from over there here, you know. And it was so good that, you know, I was opportune to come to this very occasion, you know. But this is my contribution to you. And I'm asking you again whether you guys are doing everything possible for other people to understand or learn, you know, those things that took part into the war. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm actually, it's a great, I mean, definitely in West Africa, there are several other places that have had war, as you mentioned rightly, in Liberia. I actually happened to go to Liberia, not in the right circumstances during the war, so it wasn't, I didn't have to go, but anyway. What, for me, my purpose for writing, is to really write about that sub-region of West Africa. I'm just getting started, you know. And for me, the task really is to write about my people so people can see not only the destructions and the wars that we've seen, but also our vibrancy, our strength, our wisdom, our intelligence, and our ancestry, and all of these things that sometimes are not a part of the way we're presented or spoken of. So that's really what I'm trying to do. And I also write about people who live deep in the countryside, because I come from the countryside. I'm not a city boy at all. And often that area is forgotten as well. So in the words of Albert Camus, he says that the role of a writer is not to represent those who make history, but rather those who suffer history. So I really come from that angle. And I promise you, of course, I've been thinking about it actually, that I'm going to write more about other parts of West Africa. There are other people that are already doing it also. For example, there's a fellow who wrote it in French. I think it got translated in English. His name is Amadou Koroma. He wrote something called Allah n'est pas obligé. Allah is not obliged. And it's about also West Africa and children being dragged in war. There's another guy who wrote something called, I think his name is Emmanuel Dongala. He wrote something called Johnny Mad Dog, which is also another. So there are other people writing it, but I will do my best to write from our generation. I'm glad somebody from my publishing house is here, so they would be expecting to have signed me up with more book deals. So I will take you on, definitely, and try to write more things. Yes.
Hello, and I have a question I would like to ask you. I actually have many questions, but following the tradition of your homeland, I'll make an effort to get right to the point. I'm here, as is Morris, with a group of young men, mm-hmm. and in our regular experience, these young men often see or use violence as a way to obtain agency mm-hmm. or self-expression or to identify themselves or to identify their rank among their peers. And it was so interesting, the comment that you made when you told about your grandmother's story, where she wanted you to understand that the act of taking out or pointing a gun creates a set of circumstances that don't so easily go away. Having said that, I wonder if you could say a little more, either as an author or as a witness to violence, about the lesson or the understanding that you might have or that you might express in your writing about violence and what it really means, particularly since it's something that I guess here in the West we still tend to glorify and we tend to sell it as entertainment. And I wonder what you might want to say about that.
Well, you know, I think you spoke about it a little bit, which is that when people have not really suffered violence, they have not lived it, they still have a little bit of fascination with it. They glorify sometimes. You see it in music, and you see it in entertainment and other places, because anybody who has been touched by violence cannot glorify it at all. You know what it is. You will resist it at all cost. A few years ago, we took some hip-hop artists from the United States, Wu-Tang and a few other members, to Sierra Leone. This is when the war was no longer occurring there. And these are guys who usually have rap lyrics about, oh, I have my Mactang and my this and that. First of all, these guys don't live in the neighborhoods that they rap about. They live elsewhere that's quite nice, but they say it in their song as if they're there. We took them to Sierra Leone, and they were so scared, and the war wasn't even going on. You know what I mean? But what happens is that when young people hear these lyrics, they take it to heart and try to act it out. And I always say one thing that we should teach our young people is to understand the difference between this expression of violence verbally, virtual violence, and actually the reality of it. It's very different. You play a video game, you can shoot a character, your character dies, you restart. In real life, you shoot somebody, you cannot restart. And I think we need young people to understand that, that the fascination ends wherever it is that it started. If you move any further, it's going to change your life in ways you actually do not like. And it will impact you for the rest of your life. Particularly in the cultures of the United States where it's so bent on punitive measures, not restorative measures. So when you step above over that line, you put yourself in a very awkward situation that you will spend years recovering from, if probably never come from it. So whenever you think of it, I always say to young people, the strength in any human being is actually to resist violence. That's the character that I admire. Anybody can punch somebody or get angry and push some. Anybody can do it. But it takes courage and strength to resist. Because you don't have to prove anything to anybody. When I was in high school, when I came here, nobody knew about my background. Everybody always picked on me because I was the African kid and, you know, the skinny African kid. And they would push, and I was shorter than most of them. They would push them, they always say, and I always laughed. They didn't know my background. I just laughed because I thought these kids have no idea what violence is, you know. So they're just trying to have this bravado about it. So later when my book came out, some of them said, oh man, you could have done something so bad to us if you wanted. But I explained to them is that when you experience violence, then you know that you have to resist it because you know where it would take your spirit. And when you're consuming violence, you cannot make a future for yourself because it doesn't allow intelligence to occur when you're consuming violence. It doesn't allow for you to actually begin to understand what it is that you're capable of, to understand your own mind and how you can use it for yourself and for others. It doesn't. So any young person who's sort of smitten by all these things, I want them to think of these things. If I was in the war, I would have never known I could be a writer. I wouldn't. I wouldn't know I could go to university and do that. I couldn't. All I would do is to live every single minute and be filled with all of that nonsense, you know? So when you think about it, you should think twice, you know? I do wish some of the young people would hear me in this room, and those who are not here, I wish you could pass on the message to them. With that said, I think I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.